This is an interview with Mr. Tom Reed, who has followed a distinguished career in space tracking and related fields and is currently retired and living in Canberra. Mr. Reed will be speaking with me, Hamish Lindsay, the 30th of May 1994 in Mr. Reed's home in Canberra. Mr. Reed, may we begin with how you entered the space field?
Yes, well, I was born in Scotland, and during the war I was in the Royal Navy, and I did visit Australia as part of that service. And after I had graduated in electrical engineering from Glasgow University, I joined the Royal Australian Navy and served for 5 years in this country. At the end of my period in the REN, I joined the Department of Supply Weapons Research Establishment in Adelaide and was appointed to the range head at Woomera. So I became involved in the telemetry of the British missile programs. It was during my time at Woomera that I first became involved with NASA, specifically in the Project Mercury telemetry systems, which were being implemented at the Red Lake facility at in Woomera.
Was that at the very beginning?
That was right at the beginning. Right. That was 1959. However, I left Woomera to go to Adelaide University lecturing in 1962, early 62. And I then became involved with NASA in when I was appointed the director of Auroral Valley Tracking Station in August 1964.
Okay, before we go leave Red Lake, did you have any experience or mission experience at Red Lake?
No, I didn't, no, because by the time they had launched and everything, I had left that area. But I was involved in the initiation and the testing and implementation phase.
What was your impression of the station itself?
Well, at that time, of course, it was all seemed to us to be very high-tech. Obviously, it was all equipment provided by the Americans. I did attend a course run by Bendix Pacific in North Hollywood, specifically on the Project Mercury Apollo system, telemetry systems. And compared to the equipment that we had at the range head at Woomera, which was basically had been designed mostly by WRE, this seemed to us to be pretty sophisticated equipment. Hmm. And of course, since these days, it's become more and more sophisticated.
Okay, so then you went to Auroral Valley?
Yes, and I was at Auroral Valley until August 1967, when I went to Honeysuckle Creek as the director there.
Okay, now
in preparation for the Apollo program.
You were called into Honeysuckle Creek. Can you tell us why you were called into Honeysuckle Creek?
Well, it was felt that the management at Honeysuckle at that time wasn't proceeding fast enough to ensure that the station was going to be ready to support the upcoming manned Apollo program. And I was asked to go in as a director and try and speed up the process.
Now, you had to do a lot of staff reselections. Could you describe your methods there?
Well, the staff, of course, were selected by the contractor, which in this case was STC, and they had filled almost all the positions by the time I got there. However, it was decided that we would reassign some people into different functions. For example, it became obvious to me that the facilities engineer was probably the best qualified to look after the mechanical systems on the antenna, and that's the suggestion that was made to STC, and they implemented that. So there were some changes made in that regard. There was a couple of people who decided to go, and there was a couple more were hired.
Did you use any of your Navy methods when you went to Honeysuckle? Management methods?
Well, the experience I had in the Navy, of course, I was an electrical officer in the Navy, and it was a very similar task in the sense it was managing a group of people looking after complex electronic equipment.
And what was your impression of Honeysuckle when you first arrived there? Can you describe the atmosphere and your impressions?
Well, I had been at the official opening of Honeysuckle Creek by the then Prime Minister Harold Holt, as a guest, not in any other role, simply as an interested guest. And just talking about the upcoming program with some of the people there, I realised that it was going to be quite a task to get the station ready to meet the commitments. Of course, you've got to remember that as well as Honeysuckle Creek, an integral part of the whole setup here was also Tibbin Villa.
Yes, at that stage Tibbin Villa was having the wing being initiated.
Yep, Tibbin Villa was set up as a deep space station, as you know, Deep Station 42. And then the modification was done to that to enable it to support the Apollo program. The so-called wing was added. And the wing and Honeysuckle operated jointly during the lunar phase. That was the idea of the two antennas.
And did you find that the Australian government were helping in all these activities?
Well, the Australian government, of course, was involved in... by Australian government, you mean government departments?
Department of Supply.
Yes. Well, of course, I was employed by the Department of Supply at that time, as was the director of Tibbin Villa. And when I first went there, we were still part of Weapons Research Establishment in Salisbury. But by 1968, that was transferred here into Canberra, the head office was. And, yes, I was responsible back to the assistant controller back in the department.
Was their attitude to you very helpful?
Yes, because in this particular case, it was the man who had the job was Bob Leslie, who had been the director at Tibbin Villa from the beginning, and so he understood what the task was. And I'm very pleased to say he basically gave me a blank check in terms of, I don't mean in terms of money, but in terms of programs and in terms of implementation so that we could get on with the job.
And NASA funded the whole station. Was there any input from the Australian government?
NASA provided all of the equipment, of course. NASA paid for all the construction costs, and NASA paid for almost all the operating costs. There was a small amount of money allocated by the Australian government, which, from memory, was about $140,000, and that remained constant right from the very early days, the early 60s, and in fact it did represent the personnel costs at Woomera for the, first of all, Project Mercury and then the SDDN station, which was established then.
Okay, so then we came up to our first mission. What was your function in that first mission?
Well, the first missions, as you know, in the Apollo program were unmanned. And
that's correct.
Basically checking out the launch vehicles and so on. The first manned mission that we were involved in was Apollo 7.
Now, you came onto the console, you were on the console at 11. At what stage did you come onto the operations console?
In Apollo 11, you mean?
No, the first time you came onto the... Was it the first time?
That was Apollo 7.
You were on the operations console.
Yep. Well, we had a training period ahead of the actual mission, of course. So.
Yes, yes. Were you involved in the training period at all?
Yes, yes, because if you recall, Goddard had sent out a simulation team, Goddard Space Flight Centre, and they were simulating the various flights and the support that would be required. And we were trying to process the data and acting as if that was the real thing.
And how did the station interface with these people from Goddard? Did we have any problems or were there good points?
Oh, well, the man in charge of the simulation was a fellow called George Harris, who was a very forceful personality, and I had to remind George that I was the one that was running the station. He was running the simulation.
Yes, John Saxon's already mentioned George Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And when they left, were they happy with the station?
Yes, at the end, yes, they were happy that actually, when I got there, that was the second time they'd been there. The first time I hadn't been involved in it, and I got a comment back from Bill Wood, who was the chief of that division, saying that they were satisfied that we were probably on the right track, and hopefully we were going to improve our performance to match what their assessment of what we need to be.
Because one of the problems with Honeysuckle was it hadn't had any previous experience, whereas Carnarvon had been tracking for quite a while and were familiar with the, and nearly all the personnel at Honeysuckle were new.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, in some ways, the people at Tidman Bellow obviously had experience in the deep space programs, tracking satellites and the like, but it's a slightly different activity because the initial polar program were Earth orbitals, like Apollo 7, and it's a different concept from the deep space. So, yeah, the people at Honeysuckle, for the most part, were novices at the business, and we had to weld them into a team. Although quite a few of them had already been in the other NASA activities in the country.
And after Apollo 7, we then started to move into a more operational phase because the lunar activities were quite different to the Earth orbit phases which we'd had up to that date.
Yeah, well,
because the Apollo 8 lunar phases were all new. We'd never done that before.
That's right. And
did you have any special preparations for that from your point of view?
Yes, we did. We had simulations. We developed a simulation system on the station which enabled us to simulate the lunar phase, including Apollo 8, but it was specifically designed for Apollo 11, not for just Apollo 8.
Now, you came under the console during Apollo 8, on the operations console.
Yes, I decided that that for the very critical phases, in other words, let's say on Apollo 11, the egress, that it wouldn't be wise for me to be personally involved in it because whoever was going to be there had to tie himself down to that and nothing else. So I decided that my deputy, Din, would be the one who would sit in during these critical phases, and this would leave me free to handle any other problems that came up, management problems or whatever. So what I was doing was basically handling the preparation for the critical phases and then passing over to him to actually execute them.
And Mike didn't mention that he had a lot of troubles with the media. They were trying to interface and get a lot of information which was interfering, and he came up with the idea of having an open day for the media to come in.
I don't recall that, but it's possible. Hmm. Yeah, well, certainly the media were interested, and I made it very clear to them that they were excluded during actual missions. There were no media on the site.
Right. But you had an officer who was fully allocated to dealing with the media.
Yeah, we had Bernard Scrivener who was dealing with them, but there were no media in the control room on the day.
That's correct.
Bernard Scrivener would have been talking to them outside in his office, perhaps. And incidentally, that just didn't only extend to media. There were other people in the station whose job it wasn't, the job wasn't to be in the control room, and they weren't allowed in either.
That's correct, yes. Yes, there was a lot of tension at that particular moment. Can you describe on the Apollo 11 day what you did and your feelings?
Yeah, well, of course, during the lunar phases, I stayed on the station and slept there for the whole mission and came back down. In fact, I got a Christmas card from my wife there during Apollo 8. I had been in discussion with Tech Roberts, who was the divisional chief of MSFN Engineering at Goddard, and his deputy, Bob Owen. But during the night, they kept calling me because they were trying to get the assessment of the station director's readiness and were there any last-minute problems, was everything going according to plan, etc.
What was your biggest problem, your biggest difficulty?
We didn't really, in my view, we didn't really have difficulties at that point because by the time we got to Apollo 11, we were ready to do it. The difficulty was getting the staff trained up
beforehand.
Between August 67 up till
So going into the
July
mission, 60. Going into the mission, you had no qualms at all?
No, I didn't have any qualms, and later on I'll tell you about the four contingencies that happened simultaneously, which you wouldn't expect to happen, but it did result in Honeysuckle being the station that got the first step on the moon. And to me, that was just typical of the way we had backups and backups and backups in the manned spaceflight network.
Okay, can you describe your what happened that day from your point of view?
Yes, well, as I said, I had these discussions earlier on with the Goddard Engineering people and assured them, as far as I was concerned, everything looked fine, apart from the known problem with the DSS-42 transmitter. And incidentally, because that transmitter blew up just before launch, during the TLC phase, translunar coast phase, they decided to switch support to the LEM over to Honeysuckle, away from the Tibbenbilla.
Yes, the original flight plan called for Tibbenbilla to support the LEM. And the reason for that was?
The reason for that was that Houston didn't want to be chopping and changing the ground configurations once they'd established that one particular configuration was working okay to their satisfaction. And having done that, they said, okay, we'll leave the LEM support at Honeysuckle and we'll put the CSM support to Tibbenbilla. On the day, I can recall Ian Grant did the countdown and I was supporting that part of the activity, but in other words, preparing the station for the upcoming support. On that day, as you might expect, I had a couple of people. One of them was Prime Minister Gorton, and the other was the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Supply. So
they came around during the SRT?
They came around, and he had enough horsepower so that I couldn't keep him out of the control room.
But it was during the checkout before the...
It was about past 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, so it was a couple of hour and a half or so before the actual event.
Did he make any comment to you?
No, he was just interested to see what was going on. He was pretty pleased that Astaire was playing a role in this program. Because you might recall his wife was an American, his first wife.
That's right.
So he certainly identified with the American programs.
How much warning did you have? It was a few days warning that he was coming, didn't you?
Just a couple of days warning that he wanted to come out. And to be fair, I mean, his office said, would it be all right?
Right.
So, but we felt it would be all right. The contingencies which I was talking about, which resulted in Honeysuckle Creek being the station which was actually sending the Neil Armstrong footstep down, first of all, the flight plan called for the egress to occur when Goldstone, 210-foot antenna, and the Park's 200-foot antenna had a joint view period, so there was going to be 100% redundancy in 210-foot antennas. However, Armstrong decided to come out early, and the mission controllers agreed that they wouldn't oppose that, and if he wanted to come out, he came out. And because of this, when he actually did come out, Park's didn't have a view, because Park's has to get an elevation constraint, and it wasn't quite in the beam. Unfortunately, simultaneously, there was a problem at Goldstone in the microwave system relaying the data back to Houston, and they were getting very poor slow scan TV back.
It was upside down too.
It was upside down too. That was another one, yeah. So these were the things that happened. There was a transmitter failure before launch at Tibbenbilla. There was the early egress. There was a microwave problem, and the decision to come out egress early. You know, these were the four contingencies, which resulted in the actual signal of his step coming through the 85-foot antenna at Honeysuckle Creek. And very shortly after that, the moon had risen sufficiently to enable Parkes to acquire, and of course Parkes provided a much better signal.
The best signal of the network, according to the...
At that time. And the CSIRO and Dr. John Bolton were very very proud of it. But we always had that little argument with them as to who was actually the one that did it.
That's right. The logs prove it.
Yep, and the logs and the tapes prove it, and the network conversations prove it.
And where were you when Armstrong actually walked out?
I was right behind Mike Dinn with my hand on his head.
And what were your feelings at the time?
Well, it was pretty exciting because that was a culmination of quite a lot of work on the part of hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm.
And we were a very small part of it, but at that point in time, we were a fairly important part. And I think everyone felt that all the training and all the what-ifs were justified.
And, of course, afterwards, it all went very well from our point of view.
Yes.
It was great relief.
Yeah, well, everything from then on in, the technical problems were sorted out in the network, and everything went back to the original plan.
So was it, looking back, was there anything that that worried you afterwards that you'd like to not have seen happen?
No, I think I'm chauvinistic enough to say that it was, in a way, I was pleased that it did come through Honeysuckle, because the
right.
people there had really worked hard for it.
Mm.
Worked their way up. I'm not suggesting the others hadn't, but I mean, I know they hadn't.
Mm.
And Don Gray's people at Tibb and Bella worked flat out night and day to get that transmitter power supply back up again. But there was a little goodie that I didn't expect to get.
And did you hear any comments back from Houston or Goddard about our performance?
Well, Houston were pretty well said. No, they were delighted actually with the pictures they were getting, initially from Honeysuckle and then from Parks. I mean, I don't really know what they expected to get, but whatever they got was satisfactory.
And did Goddard make any comments?
Yeah, they were happy with the performance. Mm. And if you looked in the post-mission report, which each station sent, there weren't too many negatives in that particular one.
Now, do you feel that Apollo 8 was as interesting a mission or an exciting a mission as Apollo 11? There were a lot of firsts in Apollo 8.
Apollo 8 was the first lunar mission, of course. But there was no separation of the CSM and the LEM.
A lot of us think that Apollo 8 was equally as exciting because it was the first time it actually left the Earth.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was exciting from that view, but I would have to give... I'd need to give Apollo 11 a couple of dBs up on it, I think.
Now, what about Apollo 13? I mean, 12 was fairly straightforward. We had no problems.
Well, 12 was straightforward, and by 13 I was then at Tibbenbilla. I'd gone to Tibbenbilla at February 1917.
So you weren't involved in 13 from that point?
Well, we were.
From Parks was called up suddenly. Yes.
Yes.
So you were involved from the Parks point of view?
NASA had decided originally that they could only afford the money, the cost of Parks for two missions, that was 11 and 12. And they hadn't called up Parks for Apollo 13. However, after the accident on board the LEM, they called it up fast, and I was quite amused because this was my first introduction to the DSN operations, a la the manned flight side of it.
Quite a big difference, wasn't there?
Well, the difference was that this guy rang me up and said, how soon can you get Parks up?
Mm,
I said, what are you talking about? You know, that takes weeks of negotiation with Parks and CSIRO and NASA headquarters and agreements and money and budgets. And
I remember hearing that.
Anyway, then I got a black phone call off the net which said, hey, look, we've got a problem on board the spacecraft. This is a serious thing, so think again about how soon you can do it. Never mind about the money. And the contactors people at Tibbenbilla, the space track people, were responded magnificently, got themselves down to Parks, because of course the equipment was at Parks, it just wasn't configured and hadn't been checked out.
The big problem was the links between Parks and the ACT stations, wasn't it?
The microwave links, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about staffing?
Well, the staffing came from Tibbenbilla, stuffing in parks, apart from the CSIRO operators who drove the antenna. And then, if I remember, they hastily flew out Bob Taylor from Gonard, one of the Gonard engineers, to be at that
Yes, he was there during 11, wasn't he?
Yep, he was there at 11. So he knew the system.
And did you have much connection with what was going on during 13 at Tibbinbilla?
No, not really, because...
Once it was up and running, you
Because the mission wasn't a lunar mission. It was an aborted... It was a bit like an aborted Apollo 8.
So you can't comment much about the rest of Apollo 13. So after Apollo...
No, that's right, because I mean, at that time we were starting to get ready for the implementation of the 210-foot antenna at Tibbinbilla.
Now, can you describe the differences you noted between the manned space flight network and the deep space network going between Honeysuckle and Tibbinbilla? What were the differences that you...
Well, there was one big difference was that the instrumentation systems for the manned flight were built as a turnkey operation by Collins and other United States companies, so that the whole package was checked out as an integrated package. And you had the unified S-band system and the telemetry system and the computing systems and so on. Whereas the deep space equipment had been developed over a number of years to support different missions, and gradually, as the complexity of the deep space missions increased, the complexity of the electronic equipment in the stations was increased to match the mission requirements. So it was quite different from that viewpoint. This made it more difficult, I think, for the people at Honeysuckle, because they had to learn how to use the system, bang, just like that. Whereas the guys at Tibbinbilla had started off, you know, with the easier missions, if you like, and then gradually worked their way up.
Developed. Yes, so when we first started, we used to have to manually acquire all these manual things. It was a very different attitude to the tracking, because there wasn't life at stake, for one thing. They seemed to have a different attitude to... They didn't have the complexity of all the procedures that the manned space flight...
There was no interface with the project in the deep space network. That interface was taken care of between JPL and the project. So there's no interface with the stations and the project.
Right.
Whereas there was very much an interface between Houston and the stations during the manned flight program. They had the complexity of the communication nets and the voice nets and so on. So it was just a lot more complex communications-wise in Apollo than it was in the deep space. Although subsequently, in the late 80s, it was slightly different because the deep space bit rates had come up by then, and that was becoming complex again.
And during your period, which was quite a few years, what was the general difference from when you first started at Deep Space to when you left? What were the differences in the people and the equipment and the missions?
Well, as I just mentioned, Hamish, the I just saw almost 20 years in the DSN an evolution of the equipment from comparatively simple equipment to very complex. And this was done in a number of implementation phases, like the Mark III system and the Mark IV system and so on, each time adding additional equipment and more complexity.
But at Tibbinbilla, while you were there, you absorbed the facilities of Honeysuckle and Aurora Valley.
Yes, well, back in the mid-60s, of course, we had high hopes that the Apollo program was going to go well beyond 17. They were talking about 25. And
Chris Kraft told me we were going to be very, very busy for years to
come. Very, very busy for years to come, and then it got the chop. And I think it got the chop because, from my viewpoint, the Apollo program was always politics.
Yes.
Always. That was what drove it. John Kennedy was fighting Khrushchev in the international scene. And that was his challenge to the Soviet system, and because of it, they got the money. But, of course, having achieved the objectives of putting the man on the landing of the man and bringing him back from the moon, the political objective was achieved. And anything else after that was going to be science, and in my experience, you don't get that kind of funding for science.
True.
Because the Apollo program, the main line, cost about $25 billion in 1965 dollars, which
And so how did absorbing all these other networks affect Tibbinbilla? There was no problem coping
with it. Well, okay, I was going to say, arising from the lack of a budget in relation to the continuation of Apollo beyond 17, the only other smaller program was Skylab, which was left for Honeysuckle Creek. And that was very short. 9 months program, and once that was executed, that was basically the end of the manned flight program, which required a ground network, because at that time the shuttle program was seen to be supported by the TDRS, the tracking data relay satellite systems, which wouldn't require ground stations. So we then knew by the early 70s that at some point in time Honeysuckle would be released from its manned flight duties, and indeed it was. And in 75, it came into the deep space network as an additional 26-meter antenna as part of the deep space network operated by JPL. And then in 1977, it was basically integrated into the complex at Tibbinbilla so that we had common services and common overheads. And it became that until it was closed down. It was decided to move the antenna from Honeysuckle over to Tibbinbilla, set it up, and then start to pick up the SDDN support, which Aurora Valley was then doing. And the idea then, of course, was that Aurora Valley was going to be closed down as well. Well, that's exactly what happened in 1984. The antenna at Aurora Valley was donated to the University of Tasmania.
And it's still down there, I think I've seen it.
Yeah, when you got the airport in Hobart, it's quite, the first time I saw it was quite a kind of shock, because I saw that antenna being built, and suddenly to see it sitting outside the airport in Hobart.
I think even more hurtful is seeing how Honeysuckle and the rural sites are now, just bare, empty.
Yes, well, of course, Department of Territories, Capital Territories, had some ideas that they would like to have established a ranger training station at Honeysuckle Creek for their conservation branch, and that didn't happen. And they had ideas of establishing a museum of Aurora Valley, which wasn't restricted to space but was going to include all kinds of activities that had ever occurred there. And to that end, we left them some obsolescent computing equipment. But as soon as we shut our guard service down and the place was unmanned, it was vandalised. Both stations were just vandalised.
It's very sad. So Apollo 11, I presume, would be the high point of your career. What's the next high point?
I think the next high point in my career, there was two, and I think the next one down the line would be the Voyager program.
That was quite exciting. It still is.
But that was the Jupiter-Saturn, Uranus-Neptune,
right,
which became a very complex mission and very clever, because after the it was basically only approved as a Jupiter-Saturn flyby, and then they reprogrammed the whole spacecraft to do the next part, which was quite amazing feat.
Did Tibbinbilla have any special moments or functions during Voyager?
Yes, because of the declination of both Uranus and Neptune, very southerly, we had by far the biggest view periods, and we get most of the action at Tibbinbilla on these particular two programs. And the other program, which was also exciting, was Viking in 1975.
Yes. I even find some people now have forgotten it even happened.
Well, these were pretty big deals. I mean, Viking was very interesting. It was two spacecraft at orbit, two orbiters and two landers, and the first attempt to discover life on Mars of any type. And according to the biologists, came up with an inconclusive result.
And, of course, we had three antennas there. We had the big dish at Tibbinbilla, the original dish and Honeysuckle, all supporting that, weren't they?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the first real support that was given to given by the 64-meter antenna at Tibbinbilla, strangely enough, was Apollo 17.
That's right.
Mm. And I don't think JPL were terribly pleased with me at that time because I was pushing to get it used. And once it was used in Houston, saw the result, they said, don't touch it, just let it go. We'll take it.
Right. So that was much superior to the...
Because if you recall, during the TLCs and TECs, there was this barbecuing, this rolling spacecraft for thermal. And because of that, on the Omni antennas, we kept losing signals, so they had to keep changing bit rates. Whereas with the larger antenna, they didn't have to do this, and they were very happy with that.
Also, we had the little antennas in the lunar rover at that stage as they drove around the moon.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So, but the combination of that plus the bigger antenna. However, that wasn't what the antenna was constructed for. It was constructed to support the late 70s and 80s deep space missions.
And then it was expanded again.
It was expanded. Yep, it was expanded to 70 meters to meet the Neptune requirements. I think sometimes when you talk to people about Apollo 11 in Australia, they think of Apollo 11 and honeysuckle, and certainly that was a major element in the whole program, the whole Australian part of the program. But we had the station that Tibbenbilla supporting, and that was an essential part. We had Parkes Radio Telescope, which is operated by the CSIRO, and that was an essential part in terms of getting better data back on the TV, etc. We had Telecom, who were involved with the communications between the stations and the control centres and the stations in Houston. And, of course, we had a lot of other departments who had been involved, federal government departments who had been involved in negotiations, who had been involved in the construction of the sites and so on. So there are quite a number of organisations who have been involved with the NASA tracking stations in this country.
And they all threw a lot of weight behind. They were all very keen.
Yes, they were. And over and above all that, based on our experience at WMRA, we decided that Tibbenbilla, when it was established, to go for the first contractor operation, where we had an M&O contractor as opposed to public servants, and that was done because it was almost impossible to recruit public servants because of the unwieldy administrative process to the required timescale. And so we had a lot of private companies involved, like STC at Honeysuckle Creek, EMI at Aurora Valley, Space Track at Tibbenbilla, AWA at Carnarvon.
Do you feel that was a successful move?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, very much so, because I don't believe, based on my personal experience at WMRA, when I was desperately trying to get staff, it took literally years and years to get staff at WMRA in the public service environment. And, well, for example, from memory, at Aurora Valley, EMI got the contract in November 1964, and we did our first operational tracking in the beginning of October 65. So it was 11 months, during which time they had to get the people recruited, and frequently this recruitment was done from overseas, so there's a bit of a lead time. We had to get them trained, we had to get the equipment implemented, we had to get it checked and tested and supporting. So I really don't believe that because of the cumbersome recruiting process in the public service that we could have achieved that to that timescale.
It's a very fast-moving industry.
Yeah. Plus, later on, we had to accept the fact that as the operational commitments rose and fall, the staff requirement changed as well. So we fought pretty hard back in the early 70s against these budget cuts, but it was, as I said, the fallout from the fact that the politicians in America were no longer prepared to allocate the funding, and NASA had to take its cut, and so did the network.
They had huge cuts in the States.
Yeah, well, companies like Bendix and Ford Aerospace and so on, they had thousands of employees were laid off. We did everything we could at the departmental level to cushion this, and where we couldn't cushion it, we attempted to make sure that reasonable redundancy provisions were provided to the employees. We also attempted to take care of it by attrition rather than by retrenchments.
Right. And I remember that.
At that time, there weren't that many people. I know I can remember at one of the budget meetings using the argument, look, you're telling us to cut it today, and I know next year you're going to tell me to increase it because we're going up to Viking. I said, we can't respond in that time scale. It's too short. And it's better to carry these people on a bit longer, and you avoid the recruiting costs and everything else, and they're already there. And that argument worked for quite a lot of positions, so I think we were able to save more. It could have been worse. It was worse in America.
Mm.